Finally. Finally, we're going to finish Mark chapter 12. I've been saying that for a couple of weeks now, but I think it's going to happen this time. We are going to look at the last four verses of this chapter, verses 41 through 44. Maybe we'll get past it, but given our track record, probably not. So this is the event that is recorded here is concerning the widow's mites. The widow's mites. So we are again in Mark chapter 12. That's the word cloud for chapter 12. And then we see, we've got the widow's mites. So let's go ahead and read this passage here. Mark chapter 12, verses 41 through 44. Now Jesus sat opposite the treasury and saw how the people put money into the treasury. And many who were rich put in much. Then one poor widow came and threw in two mites, which make a quadrants. So he called his disciples to himself and said to them, "Assuredly, I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all those who have given to the treasury. For they all put in out of their abundance, but she out of their poverty. But put in all that she had, her whole livelihood." So we note first, I want to before so last week we mentioned the huge contrast that we see between what we read earlier about the scribes, how the scribes needed to with this that the people needed to beware of the scribes because they loved long robes, loved the greetings in the marketplaces, the best seats in the synagogues and the best feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers, and as a result they'll receive a greater condemnation. So we see this stark contrast between the two, but before we get into that too much, let's consider the location in which this takes place. So we see that Jesus sat opposite the treasury and saw how people put money into the treasury. That's what the text says, opposite the treasury. The treasury was located, looking at the well, we'll consider the location here. The treasury was located, so we see the temple here on the screen. If you're able to watch online, a diagram of the temple and the temple complex. And so the temple itself is right here, and the temple courtyard is in the center here. And so what we have right in that middle part in number, let's see, number nine, I believe, is this thing calls it the women's courtyard. And it's right there. You see number nine at the very center of that, or in the when that major courtyard. So the big courtyard on the outside is the courtyard of the Gentiles, and so that's as far as the Gentiles could go in. That's as far as the Gentiles could go in the whole complex. And there's this wall here as a partition to prevent Gentiles, or at least to warn the Gentiles that they can't go any further. The women, the Jewish women, could enter into this courtyard right here, number nine, the courtyard of the women. And so we can see a different diagram of that here. And the courtyard of the women, or the court of the women, according to this, is what we see. And so Jesus is in this particular courtyard. This is where the widow is putting in money from into the treasury at this point. The treasury was located in this courtyard, in the courtyard of the women, and it was in this temple complex. So they were not exactly sure where the treasury was inside this particular court. Again, the court of the women was the closest that the Jewish women could get into the temple proper. And so the Jewish men could enter in, or at least the priests, I should say, could enter in this other part right here, past this door that you see on here. It would make sense that the widow would be in this particular location, this Jewish widow, and she put in her two mites. And we see that it was the week of the Passover. So we understand that the Passover is fast approaching. And so she is putting in the money that she decided to put in at this particular time. So recall, there is this stark contrast. So we talked about that briefly a little bit. There's this stark contrast between the hypocrisy and the flashiness of the scribes. And he spots the rich doing something similar by putting in much into the treasury. It says in this passage, Jesus saw that the people put money into the treasury, and many who were rich put in much. Now, it doesn't specifically say that the scribes were doing this, but we can understand and base it on what we had just read, that they may have been among the people who put in much. The Pharisees, the scribes, people of that nature, they love to be showy, to be flashy. And so we see that the rich people are doing this, perhaps the scribes and the Pharisees among them. Certainly, very likely the Sadducees, because the Sadducees were definitely among the elites in Jewish society at this time. By contrast, this one widow throws in two mites into the treasury, and it says here that it makes a quadrant. Recall that the widows were some of the most vulnerable members of that society at the time. And apparently many scribes were involved in devouring their houses to their shame, as we saw in verse 40. This meant that did I hear something? All right. So this meant that either they would have less to put into the treasury, or they wouldn't have enough to take care of their basic needs, even if they had that much to begin with. I have some conflicting information as to the worth. I was looking at different commentaries, and I saw different numbers as to the worth of a mite. But in any event, it's very small. Some say it's worth 1/256 of a denarius. Some say it's 1/288 of a denarius. One source says that it's worth 6 minutes of an average daily wage, which is a denarius. And of course, that's how much a denarius is worth, a daily wage. Regardless, its worth is minuscule. And to give you some idea about that, I have, if you recall, when we looked at giving taxes, we saw a model of, or a replica of a denarius right here. And a denarius seems to be about the same size as either a penny or maybe even a dime. So here's a dime, the smallest of our coins. And so it might be, yeah, it's about the same size as a dime. And so that is what we have here, the denarius about the same size as a dime. Now, by contrast, the mite is far smaller. The mite is far smaller. And she handed in two of these, and that is what we see. Now, keep in mind, back then, and it's sort of the case now, although not quite as much, but back then, the worth of a particular coin was based on the materials that was in the coin. So the size of a particular coin and the material that it was made of determined the worth. And so that's kind of still the case today. But since our currency has moved off of the gold standard, they're just sort of representations today of something else. But what we see is, for instance, the quarter here is traditionally larger because it's worth more. The penny perhaps is larger than the dime, But the penny was made of copper, which was worth less than whatever the dime was made out of. I don't recall what the dime was made of. The nickel was made of nickel, and so that is worth a certain amount as well, worth less than whatever the dime was made of. I think the dime may have been made of silver, and so that's why it's smaller but worth more. And so that's the case with the much smaller mite and the larger, I can get it right, the larger denarius. So the denarius worth much more. This is worth 6 minutes of work. This is worth the whole day. And so that's a very small amount. That's a very small amount. It's very minuscule. This is the Greek word. The Greek word for this mite is a lepton, or a lepton if you're trying to pronounce it accurately to the Greek. And if you're familiar with particle physics, which I'm sure we all know about particle physics, I mean, who doesn't know about particle physics? Then you're familiar with this term. It's the generic term for the smallest or one of the smallest subatomic particles. And it's called the lepton. And the most commonly known lepton is the electron. Now, I'm sure many of you do know what an electron is. That's basic chemistry, basic physics in regard to the structure of an atom. And I'm sure perhaps even especially our electricians are familiar with that, because those are the things that travel through the wires, right? For the lights and for everything that powers everything. So the electrons are some of the smallest molecules, or the smallest particles, I should say. And that's where this word comes from, a lepton. That's really small. That's really small. It must not have been a coin that was familiar to the Romans. And so we see, of course, Mark's primary audience were Roman Christians, and this coin was likely not familiar to the Romans. So Mark compares it to one of the smallest of the Roman coins, the quadrans, worth twice that of a lepton, of a mite. So clearly, this poor widow couldn't have had much more than this, and she gave what little she could. Compared to the opulence and the decadence of the scribes and the rich, it was disgusting. Not her, but the opulence and the decadence of the scribes. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't give if we are rich, but it does mean we don't have to be showy, flashy, and here, look at me about it, bragging about that sort of thing. Here we also see that, Sam.
Hey, I was just thinking about what was it, Mark chapter 6, where Jesus talks about, when you do something good, don't have people run in front of you with a trumpet like the hypocrites do. That's kind of that same showiness, right? I'm sure, you look at Abraham. Abraham was a very wealthy man, but I doubt he marched down the middle of town going, "Look how great I am, look at all I'm giving," right? That's the difference, is they're still giving. And I imagine there were some rich people who were not being showy, but there were definitely ones that were. And I think part of the lesson is about the difference in the, it isn't the amount, it's the amount relative to what they have that's in there too.
There's certainly that element of it, and we'll discuss that particular concept in a minute. But yeah, so I think you're thinking of Matthew chapter 6, not Mark 6, about where that is, because that's part of the Sermon on the Mount. And I made that mistake not too long ago, mixing up Matthew and Mark. But it's just one of those things that Jesus continually harps on, because it's such an important thing for us to understand, for us to be able to do, to take care of. And so he wants us to do good works, but he doesn't need us to be flashy about it, right? And so that's one of the key points of that section of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6. That's a good point. So Jesus, he praises this particular woman for what she has done. He praises her for her sacrifice that she was willing to make for the Lord. And as we talked about with the scribes devouring widows' houses, this passage is often used by such unscrupulous men to con the poor out of what little money that they have. So again, this passage is used by such unscrupulous men to con poor people, especially poor widows, poor, usually older people, honestly, but sometimes younger people, to con poor people out of what little money that they do have. We note here that sacrifice is good, and the Lord blesses those who give so much of themselves. However, we don't want to be like those who devour widows' houses, do we? So, there is, I think, a conflict in how we might be able to apply this passage, and I'd like to hear some input and some thoughts about that. What is the best way to express this idea of sacrifice without the ulterior motive that unscrupulous men have? The one thing that I try to do is I try to tell people we need to make sacrifices often whenever we give money in to the Lord, but at the same time, make sure that we're able to take care of ourselves. But there's that question about Jesus's praise for this particular woman. Should we follow this example? I don't know. Sam, what thoughts do you have on that particular topic?
Well, I guess there's a couple of things. As far as how to not be showy, I mean, Jesus gives us a great example, right? When you give, let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. That you can give without being showy, and you can give without people even knowing you have. I know that even over the history of our congregation, there have been a number of members who have, and I know because I had to take care of the money and do something with it, who gave very significant amounts of money to help certain situations, and they never, ever wanted any kind of recognition. They didn't want anybody to know. I think that's a great example. There have been some really great examples. I won't even mention who they are. There have been really great examples in that. But that even paying cash, so there was no trace. There was even no record. As far as Jesus praising the widow, first of all, he's praising her sacrifice. And then it does say, which was her whole living. Now, granted, we don't know how often she got two mites, that maybe that was some sort of a pension or something she was able to get from her children or what she had saved, or who knows what, right? But she might have said, if we put it in modern terms, I'm getting towards the end of the month, but I'm gonna fast the last several days of the month instead of eating so I can give that to God because I want to rely on God. And I think that's kind of the message about it. Isn't like give everything you have so you're starving in the streets. It's give knowing that your reliance is on God, that you're not doing this by your own power. And I think that's a part of the thought.
Okay. All right. Well, and that's some good thoughts there. I do think in any event that we shouldn't be demanding people pay us. And I think that's another aspect of it as well, because, I'd like to try to do is contrast the devouring widow's houses with the sacrifice that this woman was willing to make. And so what position should we be in order to best express that idea, not demanding people give us all their money, but which I think is what the scribes were perhaps doing here by devouring widows' houses. But we need to still promote the idea of sacrifice. And so that's some difficult things to consider. And I think a lot of that is left up to the judgment of the individual giving. And so what you think is the best, amount to give, what you think would be considered a sacrifice, what is the best, way in order to carry that out without, again, being put out on the street, as what Sam had said. Ultimately, whatever we choose to give is between you and God. Now, yeah, somebody at the church will have to know in order to count it, in order to put it into the church treasury, in order to deal with all of that. And maybe even if you give for tax purposes, which if you're giving two mites, it's not going to matter. but some people, again, giving cash, so there is no record of that. And so no tax benefits, but you can't prove it. So there's different things that we need to recognize. There are these three basic principles of giving that we find in the New Testament. And that's, of course, from 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 2 and 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 7. And those two passages, which I have neglected to bring up the PowerPoint here. Those two passages there. All right. So these three main principles about our giving are so important for us. These three basic principles given in these passages here, 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 2 and 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 7. We need to give as we've been prospered. That's what we see in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 2. We need to give as we've purposed in our hearts. We see that in 2 Corinthians chapter 9 verse 7. And finally, we need to give cheerfully. So these three main principles, and you know, there's the idea of sacrifice as well, but these other principles are also important. And if you haven't been prospered, give what you can. You know, if you haven't had a lot that has come in, a lot of income, man, give what you can, even if it's just a few pennies. Just like this poor widow, she gave these few, the King James calls them pennies, but they're even smaller than a penny, I think. Perhaps, I don't even know. I didn't do the measurement for what a day's wages is. And for how a penny compares, I suppose I could do that, but that's not based on minimum wage, but that's not a huge thing. Of course, it's curious to note here that Jesus praises this widow for giving more than those who were rich. And so that's another interesting thing to consider. One way that we often interpret this is that Jesus is referring to percentage. And I think that's what Sam had alluded to earlier. That the widow was giving a greater percentage of what she had, more than the percentage given by the wealthy. But, you know, that's one point that we make often. But one particular commentator disagrees with this, and I'd like to discuss this thought because I think it's an interesting one. And he says the precise point of Jesus is not a monetary one. Not, for example, that the poor widow gave a larger percentage of her money. The thought is that by giving all when others gave out of savings, she gave herself to God. Her dedication was heartfelt and inconspicuous. And God looks at the heart. Now, what do you make of that? Do you agree with that assessment that it's about percent, that it wasn't about percentage, but it was about inconspicuous sacrifice and dedication. So, Sam, what are your thoughts about that? Do you think that makes sense?
I think it's got some of it because there's several points, right? So Jesus says they gave out of their abundance and her out of her need, right? So there's obviously a degree of sacrifice there. If it's in your abundance, it's really not a sacrifice, right? It's not because you have plenty. And, you know, so there is that aspect. And of course, you know, the widow wasn't sounding a trumpet, having people run in front of her going, you know, look at me, I'm giving everything I have to God. You know, nothing like that. You, and for one, a widow wouldn't have gotten away with that in the society probably. And two, what the picture you see in these few words is all of these wealthy people, you know, who are dressed very well and probably have servants carrying the bag of gold or whatever they're putting in. And then you have this widow who's very poor. I did a little quick calculation on the mite, and given a denarius was a day's wage, and that was roughly equivalent to about $20 of today's money, that's about seven cents. So, you know, she couldn't buy a meal, a sufficient meal with that money, but that's all she had. So she was very poor, probably dressed very poor. So, you know, she probably just kind of slunk in and put it in and slunk away, you know, being very, very humble, very inconspicuous. So I think there's truth in both of those things. I think there is this thing about, is it really a sacrifice? It doesn't matter how much you're giving if it's not a sacrifice. There is a message in here about sacrifice and relying on God. And I think that's true.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And doubtful she'd be able to actually afford a trumpet. So I would wager though that it's that a denarius would be worth more than $20 in today's money, cuz you know it's worth a day's wage. And the federal minimum wage is $7.25. Multiply that by 8 hours, which is the average day. I mean, some people work more, some people work less, but you know, to try to characterize that, it comes out to $58. And so that I think would be the worth of a denarius. That's still very small, $58 a day. And so. Certainly not. So the point, of course, is that it's very small. The exact number is immaterial, really. But it's good to help get us some idea of how much this thing was worth. And it's small. It is very small. All right. So, great discussion so far. So this is, you know, another commentator, also, adds his two cents. Anyway, he adds his two cents. Some people will appreciate that. by saying that, by pointing out the contrast between this widow and the scribes, and he says the scribes sought to squeeze the last penny from widows out of greed, but the poor widow gave the last penny to the Lord out of love and self-sacrifice. So there's a difference, of course, between giving it to the a church and giving it to the temple. The temple, you know, that's given to the Lord, or at least it's used to help out in certain, you know, it's not false religion, or at least it wasn't back then. Today, you know, it's harder to tell often what is true and what is false, and which church should we give to and which shouldn't we? And that's where studying the Bible comes in to help with that. And, you know, if there's any church that's demanding that you give them everything that you have, then flee from the hills, because that's not what the Bible says, especially when they try to use this passage to justify that. This woman, this widow, was truly a remarkable woman and a model for us all, when it comes to our dedication to the Lord's service. She was quiet. She was unassuming, and she was complete. This was the last of Jesus' public teachings, and in the next chapter, he speaks to his disciples privately as a prophet. And so we have about 10 minutes left, and we can get into Mark chapter 13 if we need to a little bit. Sam, but before we do, do we have any final thoughts before we move on to the next section?
I think just when you look at the rest of the examples, and of course, this is Jesus teaching under the old law, under the Mosaic law before the cross. And so we keep it all in that context as well. But when you look at the rest of the New Testament, like you referenced in some of them, the examples of giving, the teaching on giving, I think one of the ones that you know, that's important to stress and is the free will nature of it, right? You mentioned when we were talking about Melchizedek and everything in Sunday night's lesson from Hebrews, that you know we don't have a specific percentage or a specific amount that we're commanded to give, and the under the old law they were. They started with a tenth. That was a required tax, as it were, to support the priesthood. And then they gave on top of that. There were all kinds of other offerings like we had in your Leviticus class. But in the New Testament, we give freely individually without any compulsion. Like you said, the amount is dependent on what you want to give in your heart. And you're to be a cheerful giver. You're to be generous, all those good things. But, you know, even Ananias and Sapphira, who lost their lives because of their lying to the Holy Spirit, as Peter said in Acts, you know, Peter said, he says, while it was yours, you could do with it what you want. You know, you don't have to be under compulsion, because it's not about compulsion. It's about recognizing God's blessings and giving cheerfully and freely from your heart.
Yeah, and that's right. And I have here the shekel that they likely used, because that was the temple tax. They had to have a shekel. And we see the size differential between the shekel and the denarius. Everybody had to give the shekel, regardless of who they were, their status, their wealth. And so Jesus didn't have to, technically, but he did anyways. We see in Matthew, I forgot the chapter, but he does that in the Gospel of Matthew, miraculously still, but still a remarkable thing. All right, some good thoughts, good thoughts. chapter 13 is a fun chapter. So, chapter 13, let's see if we can get over there. This is the word cloud for chapter 13. This is a chapter about prophecy. So we see the word days, which is often in those days, that kind of thing. And so coming, watch is a big word in there that's used frequently in this particular chapter. This is a difficult chapter, very much so. So looking at the sort of an outline that we've been using for this particular chapter, we're in the upper right corner here under the suffering servant. And that's what I've titled overall what Mark is about, Jesus as a suffering servant. But this particular person has decided that the suffering servant is one of the main points of this section, chapter 11 through 15, and it certainly is. I mean, 15 is where Jesus is crucified. But we see in this particular section here that he's treated as a king. In the earlier part of chapter 11, he is treated as a lawgiver or a teacher, as we see in the rest of chapter 11 and all of chapter 12. And now he's moving into the area of a prophet. He is prophesying about we'll talk about what he's talking about in a second. and that is where some of the difficulty lies. So we see he's still teaching. And he's teaching as a prophet, and this is still the day of Tuesday. So this is the, we're still on that final week, and this is still his teaching on Tuesday. So typically, this is considered about the temple's destruction, at least for some of it. And so we'll look at some of the, you know, there's some certainly some difficulties in interpretation of this particular chapter. This chapter, chapter 13, is known as the Olivet Discourse. And because it takes place on the Mount of Olives. I think Luke calls it the Mount called Olivet in Acts chapter 1. And so this is the Mount of Olives. And of course, this is right next to, just to the east of Jerusalem. And so this is often called the Olivet Discourse, found in Matthew chapter 24 and in Luke 21. So in order to interpret this properly, we need to be able to look at all of these passages in order to understand what's being talked about. Of course, we're going to focus primarily here on Mark 13. This is perhaps one of the most controversial passages in the book of Mark, as is the Olivet Discourse and the other accounts. When dealing with prophetic texts, and especially those that are eschatological, people tend to interpret things in many ways. Now, what does that mean, eschatological, eschatology? It's one of those fancy words, but it's used to describe the study of the end times. The end, of course, could refer to the end of an age or the end of the world overall. And so we need to be able to understand what we're talking about here. And there are different ways in which people have interpreted eschatology. And for this particular passage, I found four ways in which people have interpreted this passage. And I'm going to label them. We're going to really mainly talk about two of those ways, maybe a bit of the third, but overall, as we go through this chapter, we're certainly not going to get to any meat today. But there are four different ways in which to look at this that I've seen. These labels are given to different eschatological schools of thought, though they are not strictly what we are discussing today, despite some similarities. For instance, the first one I want to mention is the futurist. It's called the futurist. And this is the idea that, or this is the belief that all the events are yet to come. I haven't found any sound commentary or preacher who thinks that. This is what we often see among the dispensational premillennialists, and so that's quite a few people, quite a few evangelicals would fall into that particular category. The rapture or the 7-year tribulation, so to speak, would be among these ideas that fit into the umbrella of futurism. They will contend that the entire Olivet Discourse is yet to come. Now, this belief is untenable based on what we see in Mark chapter 13 and verse 30. What does that verse say? Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. That's pretty clear. This generation will not pass away. So all these things are going to take place in the generation that Jesus is speaking. Jesus is talking to these people, and there are some who are not going to die until they see the fulfillment of the things that are discussed here. And of course, the futurist will justify that and say, well, John saw it in the Revelation, and he's counted he was listening to this. And so I wonder, this generation will by no means pass away. Yeah, okay, but I don't think we can have a generation of one. I think he's talking about most of the people who are there. And of course, we see that in Mark chapter 9 and verse 1, some elements of that present in that particular verse as well. So I've found that most faithful brothers in the churches of Christ fall into the partial preterist category. So there's the futurist category, there's the partial preterist category. And so there's, you know, all these fancy names, but I think it's good to understand these particular labels so that we can talk about these quickly and not, you know, belabor definitions, but we can use, you know, people hate labels often, but I think it's important to use labels sometimes because it helps us to condense a particular thought down and to understand it, and to it's used for convenience, and sometimes they're accurate, sometimes they're not. You know, I know that some futurists don't believe everything that every other futurist believes, and that's certainly the case with partial preterists as well. And so, since we're out of time, I'll just mention the names of these. There's the futurist, the partial preterist, which believes that some of it has taken place in the past and some takes place in the future. So it's partial preterist. Preterist means past. There are more full preterists, or preterists who think that all of this takes place in the past. And then there's sort of a mix of some of this, and I've labeled it historicist. That might not be exactly the most accurate term, but it's the idea that that some of it takes place in the past, in our past. Now, it's all in the future for Jesus, but it's an our past. And so the historicist will say some of it takes place then, some of it takes place in the future, some of it's sort of a general thing that takes place throughout history. And so we're going to look primarily at partial preterist and preterist ideas here, because in the end, most will say, that I've encountered anyway, will say that that up to verse 30 or 31, it all has taken place in our past. And that's fulfillment in the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And then past that, there's a little bit more debate. So that's kind of the approach I want to take with the Olivet Discourse here in Mark. And I hope that's understandable. And I hope that's acceptable so that we can be benefited from it the most. Sam, any final thoughts about that? Do you think that's a good approach?
Well, for sure. Anytime you run into anything in the scripture that's not readily and easily understandable, right? And some prophecies aren't. We need to really pay close attention to context, both local context and global context. So when we study that, that's one of the things we'll be looking at for sure. And, you know, for all the things that men want to divide things up into, you know, what matters at the end is what's the lesson Jesus is teaching and what does it mean? And I think that's something that's real clear. Even if you don't understand all the details of how every element of prophecy is going to play out or when, one thing for sure, you know, you better be on the right side when it gets there. And that I think is will help us through this.
And that's a good point. In fact, I think I have later in my notes that I didn't get to right now. The lesson we can get from this is verse 37, the last verse of this chapter. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch, watch. That's the point of this passage. That we need to be ready for anything that happens. We need to be ready for the end of the world, the destruction of all things. We need to be ready for death. If all of this takes place in the past, then we still need to be ready for the Lord's coming. We still need to be ready for our own death one day. Yeah, we don't know when that day will come. And so we still need to be ready. We still need to watch and be prepared. Okay, so thank you all for your attendance. Several other people have joined us since we started. Kathy Holmes, Louise, Joy, David Potter, and Alton Kelly. So wonderful that you're all here. We'll start our live stream for our worship service in just a moment. Please stick around as we do that. And we'll see you in a moment. God bless.